This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Hello.
We just sent our January 2022 Trumpet print edition off to press. It's a special report taking up over half the issue on how to make sense of the bewildering radical changes taking place in today's society. Our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury's lead-off article, Why Your World is Changing So Suddenly, describes this and the hidden spiritual cause for what is taking place. Stephen Fleury has an article, a pretty major feature, The Communist Attack on Parents. Andrew Miller has an article on how COVID has been used as a weapon to transform America, and another one on how environmentalism is also being used to reshape and radicalize society. Richard Palmer contributed an article about how Europe is also being transformed and made more authoritarian in an article titled Lurch Toward Tyranny. And more evidence of this trend emerged this week, with several European countries getting even stricter with restrictions imposed on people who haven't received the COVID vaccine. To learn more about this, we'll go to Richard.
Yes, I don't know if I've ever had a Trumpet article get overtaken by a big event so quickly. When I was putting together that article for the Trumpet print, Austria was kind of the oddity in this new kind of lockdown, where instead of putting the whole country into lockdown, instead of making rules that are no jab, no job, it's no jab, no freedom. So for Austria, this is a rule just introduced in the last week or so, if you're unvaccinated, you cannot be out of your house without a valid excuse. So, for example, to be getting essential foods, to be going to your job under the certain circumstances, or going out to get the vaccine, that's considered essential. But apart from that, you can't be out, you can't be socializing, you can't be in other people's friends. It's not just not going to the cinema, it's not going anywhere. And so I had to go back and edit the Trumpet article to put that in there. But Austria was still kind of like the oddity. Now it's looking like they're leading the way for potentially the whole of Europe. Just in the last day or two, the Czech Republic and Slovakia have both come out and introduced pretty much the same measures. So they're putting these same kind of restrictions on, you know, no freedom if you don't have a jab. Germany, just in the last 24 hours, has announced more of a lockdown. Not quite the same thing, but there's going to be much more restrictions now, where you can't go to a restaurant, a bar, gym, hairdressers, cinema, theaters, events, unless you're vaccinated in many states within Germany. And German Chancellor Angela Merkel, who's still the current German chancellor until the coalition is there, held the door open for even more, and for potentially Germany even following in Austria's example and having this lockdown of the unvaccinated.
So what do you make of this, Richard? It's interesting that this is happening at the same time that you do have information emerging from the scientific community about the ineffectiveness of some of these vaccines, how short they are, how there is natural immunity that is just as good or if not better than the vaccines. They keep doubling down on this. The fact that this is happening in Europe is of particular interest when you look at it prophetically speaking. What do you make of this trend?
Yeah, you're right. It is interesting. I think Gibraltar, I was reading somewhere this morning, is something like the most vaccinated place on earth, and they just introduced a new lockdown because of COVID spread. So, I mean, you're right. That it seems hard to see how anyone could honestly argue that vaccines stop the spread at this point. There's more and more pressure coming on Scotland to end their vaccine mandate because of exactly this, all the scientific evidence that's coming out that shows that vaccinated people can still spread COVID. So I think when you look at all of those, then you do have to realize that, you know, there's there's a desire for authoritarianism there. There's a desire for more power. And like we bring out in our trumpet print, you know, we kind of deliberately have a couple of articles on this, one focusing on the United States, one focusing on the EU, because in both of these countries, you see a political class that want more power, that want more authority, that want more control than they would typically be allowed in the populations. And they are just jumping on so much of what has happened with COVID as an excuse to grabbing all of that power. And you see the way that just the instinctive reaction to every step along the way is, well, the solution to this is more power to the government. The solution to climate change, even more power to the government. But then I think, and then prophetically, well, we talk a lot on this show about how Europe is prophesied to be this authoritarian place, to be this authoritarian country, to be a country ruled by kings and strongmen, not democracies and committees. And in particular, Revelation 13 talks about a mark of the beast. And we probably don't have time today to get into what that mark is. But for the longest time, I even had a hard time getting my head around an empire that says, well, unless you meet this condition, you can't work or earn an income or go and buy or sell. That was hard to imagine. I mean, obviously I believed it, but it was hard to picture, well, how does that come about? And this idea that unless you meet certain government mandated conditions, you cannot earn an income, that's reality in Italy right now. That's reality in a lot of places in Austria right now. This is becoming reality all across Europe. And of course, the mark of the beast refers more, it doesn't refer to a vaccine. This is about a condition of obedience to God and God's law. But still, this idea of a government implementing this now becomes very real, tangible, and plausible. We can see it. And it just brings this prophecy alive. It shows how close we are potentially to this prophecy being fulfilled. And you can see how, in some ways, for say Austria, now that it's, if you, no freedom, no jab, if it just goes back to no jab, no job, that's an improvement. It just makes it makes that all the more palatable. I mean, one of the things that Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry wrote right at the start of this pandemic is that this is conditioning Europe to tyranny. And I think that is exactly what we see with no jab, no job, and then no jab, no freedom. European powers are becoming, or European people are becoming used to tyranny.
Yeah, where would you send people for an understanding of why this is so important, prophetically speaking?
Well, Mr. Flurry's article, Coronavirus and the Holy Roman Empire, that he had, I think that was the July 2020 Trumpet print edition, really does go through quite a few different prophecies and shows how this ties in. And I think the added bonus of going back and reading that article is we're just over a year on, well, a bit more than a year on from that. And you can also see how many of these Bible-based forecasts have happened already. And it's just got an ad. You can see that this is playing out before your eyes.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that, Richard. We will link to that article, Coronavirus and the Holy Roman Empire, in the show notes for today's program. Many of the conveniences of the modern world depend on satellites. And space wars would cause massive disruptions. Yet Russia just made a very provocative move this week that threatens exactly that. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, I'd like to start this story up in the International Space Station. So on Monday, the seven astronauts who were on board up there, they suddenly had their emergency alarms go off, and they had to quickly close all hatches to their external modules. They had to put on their suits and take shelter in their escape capsules. And they remained in this emergency sheltering position for about 2 hours before they were finally given the all clear. And what had caused all this chaos was Russia launching a missile up into space and blowing up a satellite with it. So this was a direct-ascent anti-satellite missile that the Russians launched. And the satellite they hit with it was one of their own. It was the Cosmos 1408, which was a signals intelligence satellite that the USSR had launched back in the early 80s. And before Monday, this satellite weighed in at almost 5,000 pounds, so quite a substantial machine. But the missile broke it into about 1,500 pieces of traceable orbital debris. So those are the pieces that are large enough for us to monitor. And then there are also hundreds of thousands of pieces of smaller orbital debris as well that are just too small to track. So debris traveling at orbital speeds, even very small pieces, can cause just catastrophic damage to other satellites or the ISS or anything in low Earth orbit. And that's why many people are furious about this test. U.S. Department of State spokesman Ned Price talked about this on Monday. He said, "This will significantly increase the risk to astronauts and cosmonauts on the International Space Station, as well as to other human spaceflight activities. Russia's dangerous and irresponsible behavior jeopardizes the long-term sustainability of outer space." And then NASA Administrator Bill Nelson also weighed in on this. He said he was outraged by Russia's, quote, irresponsible and destabilizing action. So, you know, as far as the debris goes and how much, you know, danger that presents to this particular band of space, the damage is already done there. But what's even more alarming is that this really wasn't a test by Russia. It was more of a show. It was more of a demonstration of what they can do. And it just proves once again that Russia is perfectly capable of striking those satellites in orbit from the ground and just blowing them up with their missiles.
Now, preventing exactly this kind of thing is obviously very high on the priority list for all nations that have satellites up there. And Russia has been among the nations that has tried to prevent these kinds of technologies from being used in exactly this way. This is pretty blatant hypocrisy.
It really is. And that's a huge part of the story here. Christopher Ford recently spoke about this. He was the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State. And he said these kinds of events highlight, quote, Russia's hypocritical advocacy of outer space arms control, with which Moscow aims to restrict the capabilities of the U.S. while clearly having no intention of halting its own counter-space program, both ground-based anti-satellite capabilities and what would appear to be actual in-orbit anti-satellite weaponry. End quote. So this is, you know, it is the kind of hypocrisy that is pretty consistent behavior from Russia. We saw the same sort of thing on glaring display with the INF treaty. That was where Russia wanted America to strictly abide by the treaty while they developed and deployed the exact weapons that the treaty banned. And now here we are, we're seeing the same thing with these space weapons. Russia goes around trumpeting the importance of outer space arms control, but then they turn around and conduct an extremely dangerous weapons test in space. So I think Christopher Ford was exactly right when he called this Russian hypocrisy.
So talk a bit about what's at stake here. If the satellites are in jeopardy, even one satellite blowing up, this could cause other satellites to be damaged in ways that create even more space junk. What's at stake for the United States, say?
Yeah, that's true. There's always a big concern about kind of a chain reaction being set off. If there's enough debris, then that causes more debris. Eventually, we could actually block ourselves out of low Earth orbit for centuries until all that debris re-entered the atmosphere. And then we know that the U.S. has hundreds of satellites in orbit that the country relies on for everything from weather monitoring to telephone and internet technologies. Of course, there's our GPS system that provides all kinds of positioning and navigation services. And then most significant, of course, are all the satellites that America's military relies on for everything from reconnaissance and communication to navigation and targeting. So it's really the eyes of some of America's most critical systems. But Steve Lambakis is an international affairs analyst, and he recently said, quote, U.S. space systems are among the most fragile and vulnerable assets operated by the U.S. military. This infrastructure is worth billions of dollars and is vital to nearly every activity of the U.S. and increasingly the armed forces of U.S. allies as well, end quote. So, you know, if certain satellites were taken out, it could truly throw America into real calamity.
What does prophecy, Bible prophecy, tell us about the potential for American vulnerability in this respect?
Yeah, well, Bible prophecy talks quite a bit about a time in the near future when America and some of its allies will be besieged by Russia and its allies. Isaiah 23, Ezekiel 27, also Deuteronomy, they all give details about that. And then Isaiah 59 gives us more information about this you know, this future time of disaster for the U.S. In verses 9 and 10, the people of America are shown to be basically without vision. It says, quote, "We wait for light, but behold obscurity. We grope as if we had no eyes. We stumble at noonday as in the night." So, you know, that's already true in a spiritual sense for America today. You don't have to look hard to see that the country is really groping around in spiritual blindness. And the vision that's absent in this prophecy could also possibly include physical types of seeing, including that we get from satellites. So when you put these scriptures all together, it really makes it more clear, I think, how the U.S. could be besieged, especially if its satellites are taken out early in that besiegement. And in light of this prophecy, I think this story about Russia conducting this anti-satellite test in space is just a really important one for us to keep an eye on.
Well, we do have an article about this from Jeremiah from a couple of years ago. Russia carried out space-based anti-satellite weapons test that we'll link to in the show notes for today's program. Thanks for bringing that to us, Jeremiah. Iran is on the cusp of nuclear weapons capability. Israel is deeply concerned. The U.S. says it's time for more negotiations to try to convince Iran to hold tight. For this story, we'll turn to Brent Nachtigall.
Yes, negotiations are due to start in Vienna or resume in Vienna on November 29th. However, there was a really interesting report that came out in Axios this past week, which shows that the goalposts have moved for the nuclear negotiations. This is set by the United States. It was that the United States was pushing for Iran to go back to the original deal to reduce its stockpile of highly enriched uranium, to go back to not creating all these more centrifuges, to not having basically all the elements of a nuclear weapons program that they had got rid of, or at least frozen, to put them about a year away from the bomb. That's kind of what the nuclear deal did. It's in theory, was meant to keep them a year away from the bomb. They would get a lot of money. So when the Biden administration came in, that was their goal. Let's get them back to that position, because they are already at 20% purity, or they at 6% purity. 20% is going up, the amount of highly enriched uranium they had. And so let's just try and get them back and incentivize them back to get them back to the original deal. That hasn't worked. Iran has every single week, it seems, increased its ability to produce, or got closer to producing, a nuclear weapon. Right now, they have a stockpile of over 60% highly enriched uranium, which is only a couple of steps away from what you need to actually use in a nuclear weapon. This week, it was reported that they are creating more centrifuges underneath the mountain that they can't be touched by, you know, Israeli bombs and such. And so they are going full steam ahead. The United States realizes this. And so they've said, according to this Axios report, that our goal right now is not to get them back to the original nuclear deal, which would freeze them at 3.3% purity or something like that, get them back to a year away from the bomb. Let's freeze them right where they are right now. Let's see if we can just stop them from moving forward even faster. And so, according to U.S. forces, this is the Axios report, the idea was that in exchange for a freeze from Iran, for example, on enriching uranium to 60%, the U.S. and its allies could release some frozen Iranian funds or provide sanctions waivers for goods. So this is crazy. So basically what it means is the United States is going to try and argue, please stop, and to get you to stop right now, we're going to give you lots of money. We're going to give you lots of money to incentivize you to stop, which, in other words, that would be could be called rewarding bad behavior, if you like. They've broken the deal so much right now, and they've sprung towards a nuclear bomb so much that the only hope the United States has is to give them more money to make them stop at this point.
Yeah, whenever we hear about anything like this, and this kind of comical behavior has been going on for years in the way that the Obama administration was dealing with Iran, and now continued under the Biden administration. I think of, you know, Lucy and Charlie Brown, where she holds the football and every single time she pulls it away just as he takes a big mighty kick and he goes flying because she fooled him once again. It's remarkable how credulous these American mediators are to think that somehow this thing that they've been trying time after time might work if we just try it one more time. But it does reflect more than just a failure to understand the thinking behind the Iranian regime. Maybe you can explain why they would try this again.
Right. It is inexplicable unless you see the greater dimension behind this, that the United States actually wants to empower Iran, to make Iran stronger. And we know that is the case. Mr. Gerald Fleury has written about this for a number of years, going back to the first publishing of America Under Attack, which I think is really critical reading for people. But I know that there's a lot of people out there that realize this as well, that the United States' chief foreign policy goal, as just worldly commentators would see it, is to flip the switch. Let's get Iran as an ally. Let's do what we can to get Iran as an ally, and perhaps then we'll have some peace in the Middle East. That's the best way possible to look at it. So that's their number one goal. They might say they're pretty deceived in thinking that would actually help peace in the Middle East. However, that's the logic behind it. And yet, it is getting to the point now that it's becoming even more hard to hold that idea, because we're not talking about just bringing someone in from the cold here that's been a pariah state for decades. We're talking about a nuclear threshold state that wants to use a nuclear weapon. That's who's been getting brought in onto the cold, in out of the cold. And so the Israelis are really worried about this. They're terrified because this administration in Israel, they have number one foreign policy goal is to not upset America. And yet America is charging forward to empower Iran so they can get a nuclear weapon, or at least get closer. I mean, in what world do you think that if you reward bad behavior with more money, that more bad behavior isn't coming thereafter? And so that is what people need to expect. The United States government is basically using nuclear negotiations to cloak the way that the U.S. can fund the Iranian regime, to allow the Iranians to get money so that they can do what they're promising to do, get a nuclear weapon and use it. I know that sounds like it's far out, but what other logic is there to the course of these negotiations? Mr. Gerald Fleury speaks about this at length in I think we mentioned it last time, chapter 6 of the Great Again book. It's really important to read that chapter. It was written back in 2013, yet it's so applicable. Just one quote, if we have time, from that. I'm actually going to quote from Charles Krauthammer, the late Charles Krauthammer, what he said shortly before he died. He said this: I think the real issue here is not the fact that we did ransom, meaning pay the Iranians billions of dollars to get those Americans back. I think people know we did it in a lot of disguised ways. It's that they lied, and they lie shamelessly. This is talking about the United States, Obama's administration, Biden's administration now. They lie shamelessly, and they lie when the lie is uncovered. That's what is so scary. And they lie about the entire Iran deal. This is the tip of the iceberg. Every time on the Iran deal that we were promised we would hold the line on X, Y, and Z, we did this, or we're getting inspections, they lied all the way through. And so then he goes on and talks about there's a lot of suffering that's going to come from this. And so even he could really see that everyone's lying here. The Iranians are lying that they're going to keep to what they've promised, and the Americans are lying that they're going to keep to what they're keep Iran held back in the nuclear deal. That wasn't the case, and we're just seeing that continue right now. You cannot believe what the United States mediators are saying today, the same ones that lied during the first version of the nuclear deal, and it's making the Middle East an extremely dangerous place.
All right. Well, thank you for that, Brent. Chapter 6 of Great Again. You can read that. We'll link to it in the show notes on today's program, and it is at thetrumpet.com. We appreciate that. The trial of Kyle Rittenhouse has been unfolding in the United States. It's been a stunning display of political bias and race baiting by the mainstream media. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, tensions in Kenosha, Wisconsin are definitely rising. The National Guard has been called in. Shopkeepers are boarding up their windows. There are protesters surrounding the courthouse and mysterious barricades of bricks are popping up around the city that no one even seems to know much about, all pointing to the fact that the city is bracing for a repeat of last summer's violent riots if Kyle Rittenhouse is acquitted of the charges against him. Now, the case against Rittenhouse finished up its closing arguments on Monday, and many political analysts had expected that Rittenhouse would have been acquitted by the jury the following day, on Tuesday. Now here we are on Friday, and nothing's happened yet, which shows that these deliberations amongst the jury are taking some time. It seems to be the case that the evidence is that he should be acquitted, but in the light of protesters surrounding the building you're in and these barricades going up around the cities, the jurors are trying to kind of steel their nerve to make a decision that may be quite unpopular. Now, on Tuesday, our executive editor, Mr. Stephen Fleury, wrote a trumpet brief after the closing arguments on the case had finished, just really kind of summarizing what happened and presenting the evidence here. If you'll remember, I guess, for those who haven't been following this case as closely, last summer during the race riots in Kenosha, a teenage boy named Kyle Rittenhouse, who lived a couple towns over from Kenosha, took a semi-automatic rifle, went into Kenosha with the intention of guarding a car dealership from being vandalized, and in the chaos of the evening ended up killing two people and injuring a third. And so that's what the murder charges against him are about. However, they've released the drone footage of what happened, and it definitely shows that the first man killed, Joseph Rosenbaum, chasing Rittenhouse through the streets. He'd threatened to kill him earlier in the evening, and that Rittenhouse was actually the one with his gun pointed down towards the ground when Rosenbaum lunged for the gun, tried to take the gun away from him, and only then he shot four times. Then later in the evening, I think after word had spread that he'd killed somebody, he got involved where a big scuffle where like three or four people attacked him, one of them aiming for his head with a skateboard, who was the second man killed, and then a third one injured in that same altercation. So when you look at the drone footage, I mean, at least the footage I saw, made it look like a pretty clear case of self-defense. I mean, he definitely did a gutsy thing by taking a semi-automatic rifle into an active race riot to try to protect this car dealership. But it looks like that he was defending himself from people who were coming after him pretty with an intent to harm while he was standing in front of this car dealership. And I think most of the jury seems to be leaning in that direction. We'll see what they decide. But the media, as you'd expect, has definitely come down hard and heavy with that he's a white wing supremacist who was instigating the violence, regardless of what video footage may or may not say. And so you definitely see a lot of people buying into the media narrative and ready to burn that city to the ground if this goes the wrong way.
Well, that article by Stephen Fleury just makes a strong point that you have a white young man who, first of all, there have been all kinds of details about his side of the story that the media completely overlooked in order to paint him in the worst possible light, that he actually killed two white men, that there were no people of any other race involved in these specific incidents. It's just that it happened in a city that was being looted and burned because of riots related to a racial incident, which was based on misinformation to begin with. But the fact that the media have incessantly promoted the notion that Kyle Rittenhouse was a white supremacist and that's what motivated his actions, it's completely manufactured out of thin air And they continue to promote it even when the details have come out. And there's no conclusion that you can draw from this, but that they want more race riots.
Yeah, no, when you look at the case and just all the evidence that's emerging of what really happened, and then the disconnect with what the media is saying, like I said, paint this young man in the worst possible light, you really can't be left with any other conclusion that they want another racial incident in Kenosha. I mean, what do you expect when you keep telling the people over all the media networks that this guy is a white supremacist working for a militia group who's randomly gunning down people in the streets of Kenosha, when the video footage shows that he's a young man defending a car dealership, backing up, trying to get away from these people who are coming after him, and then only shooting at the last minute in self-defense. It's the jury pretty much, it looks like they're saying, it's like, well, that's the evidence shows he's innocent, but the media is saying he is guilty. So you're trying to create this narrative of a great injustice that's going to cause another racial incident in Kenosha that the government's going to have to solve. One of the articles we can put in the show notes is from our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, on the war against police. That really goes through that the left has done this on purpose repeatedly in order to like create a problem so you can pose a solution. It's like really show how racist the local police network in Kenosha is so that the government can come in to start supervising and reforming the police departments and really really building a federal police state in America. America is quite unique in its local decentralized police system, which people are turning against now because of all these different racial incidents that are in some cases exaggerated, and in many other cases just manufactured whole cloth to cause this problem.
Well, I would encourage you to read that article from Stephen Fleury, why is the corporate media spinning the Rittenhouse trial? This is just more evidence that is among a lot that is mounting of just how much there are people who are aiming for revolutionary changes in society, and they're willing to do whatever it takes to achieve that. We'll also link to that article from Gerald Fleury, The War Against Police. Thank you for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, more warnings about the dramatic and dangerous developments in China's nuclear weapons program and more shameful fallout from America's evacuation from Afghanistan. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
We've been following the dramatic advancements in China's nuclear weapons program, and more analysts say this could actually be the biggest story in the world right now. For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, there was a very sobering analysis in the Financial Times this week. It goes through several of the nuclear developments from China that we've spoken about on recent episodes of Trumpet Hour. It discusses the landmark hypersonic glide vehicle tests that China conducted over the summer, which proved that China could fly nuclear warheads past U.S. missile defenses. This Financial Times report also reviews the Pentagon's recently upgraded estimate that says China's accelerating its buildup of nuclear weapons and will soon quadruple its arsenal to at least 1,000 warheads. The report also discusses the hundreds of new silos for nuclear weapons that China has been building, and also how China probably now has a nuclear triad, meaning land, sea, and air-launched missiles. So these are all just momentous milestones that China is rapidly crossing. It's all overwhelming evidence of a major shift in China's nuclear posture. And the Times quotes Admiral Charles Richard. He commands U.S. nuclear forces. And he recently said, quote, "Breathtaking may not be enough to describe China's nuclear buildup." And then General John Hyten, the vice chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, recently said, quote, all the hypersonic weapons are building, all of the nuclear weapons are building, are not meant for their own population. It's meant for the U.S. We have to assume that, and we have to plan for that. So just a chilling warning there. And then General Mark Milley, chair of the U.S. Joint Chiefs, weighed in on this as well. And he said, when you put all of China's advances together, he said, quote, we're witnessing one of the largest shifts in geostrategic power that the world has ever experienced, end quote. So it's hard to state it any more dramatically than that. And the facts show that this is just a truly alarming shift that's underway here.
That Financial Times article, just spelling out all of these advancements, you look at just how many of them and how many fronts China is making all at once. And it does definitely expose, and we've talked about it on recent programs, just how determined China is to maximize the threat that it poses with these nuclear weapons. You look at, it seems like the United States really is behind in trying to counter this. What about the nations in China's orbit as they see China making these advancements? We've talked about just how much they are kind of seeing the way the wind is blowing, the United States presence in the world waning and China advancing as it is. How much is this reshaping the landscape in Asia geopolitically?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question, because the U.S. has invested billions over the last 7 decades or so to build this alliance that basically helps to contain China. You know, we've invested so much with South Korea, with Taiwan, with Japan, with the Philippines, and it's all designed to contain China's rise. But right now, more and more analysts are concerned that because China's power is growing relative to the U.S.'s so quickly, that we could soon see a repeat of the old Cold War phenomenon that's sometimes called Finlandization. So that's when Finland was forced to abandon the powers, you know, the U.S. and the Europeans that it naturally wanted to ally with. It was forced to abandon them and really to support the Soviet Union's foreign policy goals, just because it shared a border with Russia, and the Russians had overwhelming military superiority over the Finns. And Finland knew that if they didn't support Russia, then the USSR could easily occupy and conquer them. So right now you have Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan, which are U.S. allies at present. But if the current trends continue, these countries could soon be in a situation similar to the one that Finland faced back then. Robert Suffer, the top Trump administration defense official for nuclear policy, he recently spoke about this, and he said, quote, Japan, South Korea, or Taiwan could develop their own nuclear weapons, or they could start to accommodate China. China's strategy is to expand its regional hegemony and influence and try to peel off allies from the U.S. The more nervous the allies become, the more they accommodate China, end quote. And the Trump is expecting Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, and other Asian nations to eventually join forces with China. And this this phenomenon that you could call Finlandization, this very well could be a big part of how that happens, at least in the early phases.
How do you view this, prophetically speaking, Jeremiah?
Yeah, well, Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry wrote a very powerful article in our February 2020 issue. It's called The Climax of Man's Rule Over Man. And the article is built around a prophecy in the Bible that says an era called the Times of the Gentiles will begin shortly before the end of this present age that we're in. And he talks about how American and British leadership, for decades, that was the main stabilizing force for civilization. It was imperfect, but it was overwhelmingly stabilizing, and they you know, brought a lot of blessings to many people. But that era is now ending, and the times of the Gentiles is beginning. And in this new era, we can expect the U.S. and the U.K. to lose power, while Gentile countries like China will become the new global hegemons. So we have right now we have leading analysts saying China's increasing nuclear power represents what they're calling one of the largest shifts in geostrategic power the world has ever experienced. And the Bible, in these prophecies, tells us that we're supposed to be expecting one of the largest shifts in geostrategic power that the world has ever experienced. So you can really see how we're already in the early phases of this shift into the times of the Gentiles. And I just hope that anyone who hasn't will read that important article by Mr. Fleury, The Climax of Man's Rule Over Man.
Okay, thank you very much, Jeremiah. When America evacuated from Afghanistan, it removed its diplomatic presence entirely. The trouble is, America still has interests there, and now it is having to beg Qatar to help in dealing with the Taliban. For this story, we'll go back to Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, it was revealed on Friday from Secretary of State Blinken that Qatar is going to formally represent the United States' diplomatic interests in Afghanistan. And this is apparently meant to help facilitate Washington's engagement with the country's new leaders, new rulers, Islamist rulers. And so, as you mentioned there, when the United States decided to leave, then there's no diplomatic presence there. But now there will be a renewed diplomatic presence. U.S. interest, there will be a U.S. interest section in the Qatari embassy inside Kabul now. And so, again, I mean, right now it would be political suicide or further political suicide to try and to foist on the American people that you want to have relations with the Taliban government, that you're going to have to open up diplomatic relations. And so what the United States is doing with this is essentially doing that same thing, but through the Qataris. Now, the big question is here, I mean, why Qatar? Qatar obviously does hold has been in part a U.S. ally for a while, just because of the fact that it's got a massive U.S. air base based in Qatar. Most of the people that were evacuated out of Afghanistan came through that U.S. air base inside Qatar before they made their way to the United States, and that's where they were processed. However, what the important takeaway here isn't just that the Biden administration does want to have relations with the Taliban going forward in some way, but that Qatar is going to be the mediator, or Qatar is going to be an even closer trusted ally of the United States to accurately portray or accurately pass along U.S. interest to the Taliban. And this speaks to a really horrific relationship, I think, that is kind of been really covered up over the years. That is the relationship between the Qataris and the Obama administration. Just by way of reference, the Qataris, while they hold a U.S. base, and they want to hold a U.S. base because it brings a lot of attention to them. It actually makes them seem like a more central player rather than being all the way aligned with Iran. They kind of hold middle ground sometimes between the Saudis and the Iranians, and that's the position they like to hold. But they're also funders of Hamas. They are paying, like, suitcases of millions of dollars are going into Gaza to pay Hamas. That comes from Qatar. They're also the chief financier of the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood's basically a Qatari-owned outfit. They fund it, along with some from Erdogan, the Turks. And so what else does Qatar do? Well, they have Al Jazeera. They fund the Al Jazeera network, which basically was pushing the line to bring down Mubarak back in 2011, 2012. They also fund the Brookings Institute in the United States, which was the chief think tank that was pushing for the Iran nuclear deal. They fund lobbyists all through DC to try and push a pro-Iran slant. And so here we have the United States not just, you know, picking an Arab state that has relations with the Taliban, they're picking Qatar. And this is, the Qataris are no friend of the United States. Yes, there might be an airbase there, but they are in bed more with the Iranians than they are with the Saudis. And so I think it's just another indication of this change of the strength of this alliance that is building between the Biden-Obama administration, Iranians, Qataris, basically any Islamist camp, and the Obama administration, this third term of it. That is becoming more obvious.
It's very consistent with really even what we were talking about in the first half about the United States foreign policy really aiding Iran in its endeavors in the region.
Right. And I think that what you see here is the prophecy that we go to a lot to talk about Iran's rise to coming to dominate the Middle East. It has other nations involved in this alliance, namely including Egypt, I think, is the big player that doesn't kind of defies logic because they're a Sunni state, not a Shiite state. And so how does Iran bridge that gap to lead a massive Sunni state such as Egypt? Well, it'll do that through its partnership with the Muslim Brotherhood. And when you see the Qataris getting involved with the United States, and you see the United States getting ready to fund Iran more with more money through this next temporary nuclear deal, you can really see both parts of this King of the South alliance that's mentioned in Daniel 11 really coming together, with the United States being a pretty big factor, being part of the glue that is bringing it together as well, through the Qatari angle as well. I think the King of the South book can really ground people in this prophecy so they'll know what's coming ahead.
All right. Thank you very much for that, Brent. A new report sheds more light than ever on just how extensive and far-reaching the Nazi presence was in the German government for decades after World War II, even to very recently. For this story, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, I've been following this story for at least a decade or so, as we get more and more revelations from each government department about how infiltrated it was with Nazis. Josue Michels beat me to covering this latest one. But the process that you've had is just department after department producing these reports, looking at their Nazi past. And basically for each government department, whether it's the civil service, the treasury, the judiciary, any of these, they made a couple of main claims in the decades after World War II. So first of all, they said during the war, the people working in this party, in this department, they were not Nazis, or at least they were not true believers. Some would even make claims saying, well, actually, our people, they stayed in their positions so that they could frustrate the Nazis and so that they could slow things down a bit and kind of throw sand in the works. But they certainly weren't true believers. They certainly weren't really on board with it. And then the second main claim that they made is, well, after the war, anybody who was a true believer, any real Nazis, they were cleaned out. And so all of these departments claimed, well, we just have a completely clean bill of health. There are absolutely no Nazis or anybody with any Nazi sympathies here. And then I think around 10, 15 years ago, you start to have some historians going back and looking at the archives from these departments and absolutely blowing up this story. So we've seen it for the judiciary. We've seen it for the police. We've seen it for the treasury. We've seen it for the civil service. I think we've seen it for the chancellor's office. That might have been one of the most recent ones. And now this latest report comes from the prosecutor's office, looking at their involvement with the Nazis. So they found that between 1973 and 1959, for example, this time period where generally people claimed we got all the Nazis out, actually 75% of the staff in senior positions were former Nazi members. Among federal prosecutors responsible for criminal prosecution in 1966, it was 91% were former Nazis. The final kind of Nazi member didn't leave the department until 1992. Writing about some of these revelations, Tagschauer.de wrote that after 1945, it is well known that the German judiciary in post-war Germany was heavily riddled with former Nazi lawyers, but the true extent is only now gradually coming to light. Here was another quote from a different, I think it was a different news source. There's not been a break, even a conscious break, with the Nazi past, even in the case of the federal prosecutor's office. It was the same people that just kept on going. They gave the example of one individual, these reporters did, Wolfgang Frenkel, who was an attorney general for just a couple of years in 1962. And he actually worked on dozens of death sentences during the Nazi era. He was responsible for sentencing 30 people to death from 1936 to 1943. And he just carried on working in the prosecutor's office. And of course, this is part of the reason why so many other Nazis got away, because the German judiciary, the police, the intelligence service were full of former Nazis. And so those few Nazis that were actually on the run, they turned a blind eye to. This is how some very high profile people were able to hide quite easily. A lot of these departments knew where they were, but those departments themselves were thoroughly compromised. And this is really worth watching because this is just, there's such a specific fulfillment of a forecast that Herbert W. Armstrong made. He talked about how that these Nazis would go underground at the end of the World War II, that they have now gone underground and that they'll be working on shaping this new Germany. And he's been proven exactly 100% right. I think people did scoff at that at the time. But there have been so many reports showing that every aspect of Germany, there were their underground. And he was making those forecasts because that's exactly what Revelation 17 says. It says that you would have this beast power that refers to this modern European power. It would be on the scene and then it would disappear. It would go underground into the bottomless pit. So what you see in Germany matches exactly what Mr. Armstrong said because it matches exactly what the Bible said. It's just a fantastic confirmation that everything we've been saying about Europe and that Mr. Armstrong said for decades is absolutely true. And you can continue to rely on that Bible prophecy going forwards into the future and into that hope-filled future too.
Yeah, and you put that together with what the Bible says we can expect in the future from Germany, along with reports of continued problems with Nazi sympathizers within Germany, and it all kind of fits in one picture that is perfectly in line with the Bible's prophecies. Well, thank you for bringing that to us. We will link to the show in the show notes to Josue Michel's article, Nazis Everywhere in Germany's Federal Public Prosecutor's Office. Thank you very much, Richard. One final story. Recent elections in America didn't go so well for Democrats, and many Republicans feel like they're in good position to do well in the next elections. Donald Trump disagrees. To learn about this, we'll go to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, they had a pretty important interview that happened this week that didn't get nearly as much media coverage as it should have, where the MyPillow CEO Mike Lindell went down to Mar-a-Lago, Florida on Tuesday to talk to President Donald Trump. Mr. Trump had a lot of criticisms for the current administration, criticizing the horrible Afghanistan fiasco that's established a new terrorist state over there, criticizing the border catastrophe that's seen almost 2 million illegal immigrants flood into the nation this year so far, criticizing the supply chain problems, the Nord Stream pipeline, inflation, and many other crises. But the biggest thing they talked about was the election fraud in the 2020 elections. Mike Lindell being pretty famous now for his role in trying to expose Dominion voting systems. He pitched a new idea during this interview that he thinks the Dominion voting machines need to be melted down to be into a prison bars for the people who made them. Nice. So we'll see how that goes. But President Trump, he really did make a good point where he said a lot of his supporters keep telling him to let this election rigging thing go and focus on the 2024 election, focus on getting reelected here in 3 years. And Trump came back with, he said, when you look at what the Biden administration's done in 9 months, he's like, everything I did to make America great again, they undid in 9 months. He's like, said, if you give them another 3 years, we're not even going to have a country anymore.
Yeah.
And then also point out the fact that he said, when I go to rallies, he's like, actually the thing that the people are the most interested in is the election steal. He's like that gets more mileage than the border crisis or the Afghan fiasco or anything else mm-hmm. you could talk about. So he said, just even from a point of political strategy, he's like, if you'd had more Republicans campaign on exposing the election steal, they might do better. But the bigger picture is, like I said, it says that if the election was stolen in 2020, then we can be as popular as we want in 2024, but if it's rigged, what does it matter?
It is stunning that more Republicans don't see that reality. Brad McDonald wrote about this in his Trumpet brief yesterday. It's called Rhinos, Donald Trump, and Confronting Evil, and just talked about what a dangerous line of reasoning this is. If we forget about the past and just look forward, getting kind of sucked into this trap to think it's almost like this biggest crime in American history, this election steal, pretending like it didn't happen, just saying, well, it's in the past, let's look forward, as if they can trust the election process the next time around. The fact that Donald Trump is sticking to his guns, he actually has the support of a whole lot of Americans.
Right, yeah. I think, no one tests public opinion polls after the last election, but, I mean, some of the public opinion polls that we have shown that, like, even a majority of Americans, definitely a majority of Republicans, believe the election was stolen. But even a significant minority of Democrats, like a third of Democrats, thought that the election may have been stolen. So, I mean, if that's the case, then you'd think, well, that's got to be the most important thing you could do if they're using, it's like Mike Dendell says, if they're using the Dominion voting machines to adjust the vote tally, then, I mean, that's got to be your biggest problem. You don't even have a country anymore. You don't even live in a democracy anymore.
Yeah.
And it did remind me of something we can put in the show notes from our editor-in-chief, what will happen after Trump regains power, where there's a statement he makes in there where he says he's talking about this verse 28 in 2 Kings 14 that talks about an end-time Jeroboam warring to recover something. And he says there are different ways you can war, but the indication is that regaining office may take considerable work. Donald Trump will have to fight for it. It doesn't have to be military action, but it certainly could. President Trump could also lead some states to secede from the Union, and that would lead to some kind of warfare. But like I said, based on that analysis of 2 Kings 14, it does show that there's this process to recover office is more akin to a war than an election, which is along those same lines of what Mr. Trump's now thinking, that is like you can't just forget about warring to expose the election fraud and run an election, because if you run the election the normal way, they'll just rig it again.
Right. Well, it is remarkable that all of this continues to captivate so many people's attention 1 year after the election. And in some ways, it seems the consensus that there was a problem with the last election actually grows. There has been quite a bit more evidence uncovered over this past year, and you're not going to hear it from the political classes. You're certainly not going to hear it from the media, but the public knows the truth. A lot of the public has come to recognize that, and it does point you back to what Gerald Fleury has been saying all along, that something dramatic is going to happen, and we can continue to sit on the edge of our seats and watch for that. Thank you very much, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Parker Campbell for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Alexander Graham Bell. Concentrate all your thoughts upon the work in hand. The sun's rays do not burn until brought to a focus. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.